Well, hello there, Judge Gertner. It's good to see you.
Good to be here.
Nancy Gertner is a retired federal judge, for those of you who don't know her. She sat on the Massachusetts District Court for years, and she's also a senior lecturer on law at the Harvard Law School. And before that, she was a civil rights and defense attorney. So, Judge Gertner, about the court that was a notch or two above you, the high court— here's a question for you. How many civil rights attorneys or former defense attorneys have become justices on the Supreme Court?
Two in its entire history. Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Thurgood Marshall. That's it.
Two of them.
That's right.
Okay. Wow. Well, so what about a public defender then? Because it wasn't until 1963, right? That the Supreme Court ruled that people have the right to a defense attorney, even if they can't afford one. That was the Gideon v. Wainwright case. So we talked about general defense attorneys and civil rights attorneys. But in the 60 years since Gideon, has a former public defender ever been elevated to the Supreme Court?
No. Let me repeat that. No.
No. Okay. So there's never been a Supreme Court justice of the United States that had experience as a public defender.
That's right. Never.
Well, this is on point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it's true. While it is the Supreme Court of the United States that affirmed the constitutional right to a defense attorney, that same court has never had a justice who served as a public defender. But could that soon change?
I had the privilege of serving as assistant federal public defender in Washington, D.C. some 16 years ago.
Today, Supreme Court confirmation hearings begin for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. If confirmed, she'd not only be the first Black woman on the Supreme Court, she'd be the court's first former public defenders. And senators will certainly question her about it. Now, Judge Jackson has never shied away from talking about her legal experience, as she did in April of 2021 when she was nominated to serve as a judge on the D.C. District Court.
As part of that experience, I represented people. I represented them in the appellate division of my office. So all of my clients were convicted. And I think that the insights that one gains from that kind of professional experience really can be very helpful in future endeavors, especially if you go into the judicial service, as I have.
Jackson served as a public defender from 2005 to 2007, defending clients from everyday Americans to terrorism suspects at Guantanamo Bay in appeals cases, I should note. And that's important because she recalled how her clients had already been through the most consequential proceeding in their lives. That's how it landed them in appellate court. But no one had explained those proceedings to them.
And I remember that experience from all those years ago when I became a trial judge. One of the things that I do now is I take extra care to communicate with the defendants who come before me in the courtroom. I speak to them directly and not just to their lawyers. I use their names. I explain every stage of the proceeding.
Now, Judge Jackson, again, this is from April of 2021. She said that in each of her sentences, she explains to the person standing before her why they were found guilty, why their behavior was considered harmful and illegal, and why, as a judge, she believed they deserved the sentence she was giving them.
I think that's really important for our entire justice system, because it's only if people understand what they've done, why it's wrong, and what will happen to them if they do it again, that they can really start to rehabilitate. So there is a direct line from my defender service to what I do on the bench, and I think it's beneficial.
But of course, it's precisely that experience, that direct line, that some senators today will vigorously call into question. So let's talk about it. How much of a difference will it make to have a former public defender on the Supreme Court? And again, Nancy Gertner, former federal judge, is here with me. Judge Gertner, will it make a difference?
I imagine that it will make a difference, and for this reason. One of the most interesting things that Justice O'Connor said when Thurgood Marshall retired from the bench was that his presence in the room made a difference. He raised issues that the other judges didn't know about, the context that they couldn't see. And I think that that's what's going on here. People think of the court as sort of the application of the law to the facts as if judges were robots. But oftentimes, understanding the context in which things happen, the context in which police officers have to operate, the context in which searches take place, all of that matters enormously if you have some understanding of what that context is.
Well, you started off the hour with us saying that we've only had two justices that had any kind of experience on the civil rights or defense side of things. That number continues to astonish me. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, to some degree, that's the way the federal bench has skewed in general.
Okay.
The overwhelming majority of judges, at least until O'Connor, were white, male, corporate, or former prosecutors. It was very, very unusual to have someone who didn't fit that model. With O'Connor, suddenly there were women, but it wasn't until Thurgood Marshall that you suddenly had someone who had experience dealing with poor people, who had experience dealing with people who were facing charges. It's interesting. The Republicans I know are loaded for bear to question Judge Ketanji Brand Jackson, but the well, you think that they, among everyone, should care about excessive government power, about the extent to which defenders stand between an individual and the government and enforce rights or seek to enforce rights. So someone with that perspective is really, really, really important. Laws don't enforce themselves. Even the judges on the Supreme Court have to exercise some judgment as to what's important and what's not. And her experience can enter into that calculus.
Mm. So we're going to talk more a little bit later in the show about the Supreme Court and its makeup and the impact that that's had in detail. But Nancy Gertner, I actually was particularly eager to talk with you today because you essentially have been in similar shoes, right? Having had a career as a civil rights and defense attorney and then being appointed to the federal bench. Just tell me, how did that actually shape what you did as a judge?
Well, sometimes it meant that I saw things that other people didn't see. Other judges didn't see. So, for example, what Judge Jackson was just talking about with respect to making sure you understood the impact of the exercise of government power against an individual, and you took pains to explain what was going on to the people that were in front of you because you thought you understood that moment was critical. Critical for the country, critical for the society, critical for that person. I had been a defense lawyer. I knew what it was like to walk into a courtroom with your client and walk out without him, to watch him being taken away in chains. And that affects how careful you are in imposing horrible sentences on people. You understood the significance of the moment personally and, existentially. It mattered when, I remember a conversation with a colleague about whether police officers lie. And having been a criminal defense lawyer, I didn't see it all the time, but I surely saw it sometimes. And this particular judge, who came from a suburban area, being a big firm lawyer, said to me that, I think it's, he'd never seen it in his experience. And what that means is the threshold for evaluating credibility is different for him than for me. I could envision it when I saw a police officer behaving in inconsistent ways. I could envision it. He might be more willing to say, it's probably just a mistake. So my experience figured into judgments I made in the courtroom. It didn't determine it, right? I mean, it wasn't that, the defendants walked out of my courtroom or civil rights plaintiffs won. It certainly enabled me to see the context and understand what was going on.
Yeah. Well, so on the Supreme Court, justices are making determinations of constitutionality, right? Whereas you were hearing cases that were appealed to you that were, criminal cases, essentially.
Right.
But, you know, everything that you just said is exactly some of the reasons why some of the senators are concerned about Judge Jackson's background. I mean, let me ask you, when you say that you know, you knew how it felt to walk into a courtroom with your client and then walk out without your client because he or she had been incarcerated, do you think as a judge that made you want to be more lenient towards defendants?
It made me want to be more careful. It made me want to be more careful. It made me want to sort of pause and think deeply about what I was doing. And my experience is not, I mean, it's different than what a Supreme Court justice would be like. But as I said, laws don't enforce themselves. Usually you have to understand the context. And there are so many areas in which, the judges are saying, will this make a difference? And the questioning of jurors, for example, will this question make a difference? Well, I've been there. I've questioned jurors when I was a defense lawyer. I saw the differences that it made. In searches, a police officer will come and say, I had to do this. It was an expedition that required me to cut these corners. And if you have some understanding of what the setting is, you might make one judgment and another judge would make a different judgment. Although the Supreme Court is making constitutional decisions, they're constitutional decisions that have to take into account or should take into account the context of the real world. And all of the judges bring their real world experience to bear. And as we've seen, it's a very narrow real world experience that they're bringing to bear here.
It is profoundly narrow. And we're going to talk more about that after we come back from a quick break. Judge Nancy Gertner joins me. She is a former district judge. She served on the Massachusetts Federal Court. She's a senior lecturer on law at the Harvard Law School. And by the way, next month she has a book coming out. It's an anthology of the rulings from Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But when we come back, we'll keep talking about the fact that if confirmed, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson would be the Supreme Court's first former public defender. And what difference, if any, would that make? So stay with us. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today is day one of the Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. And if confirmed, she would become the Supreme Court's first ever justice who has experience as a former public defender. That would make her amongst many firsts, including, of course, the first Black woman to serve on the high court. Nancy Gertner joins us today. She's a former federal judge in the Massachusetts District Court, and she's a senior lecturer on law at Harvard Law School as well. And let's listen to a little bit from Judge Jackson. This is during her confirmation hearings for the D.C. Circuit Court, and she addressed the claim that a former public defender cannot function as an impartial judge.
When you become a judge, you take an oath to look only at the law in deciding your cases, that you set aside your personal views about the circumstances, the defendants, or anything else, and you apply the law. So I guess I would just say that that I wouldn't see any distinction between people with prosecutorial backgrounds and defense backgrounds in their ability to stay true to their oaths.
Well, joining us now is Benjamin Barton. He's a professor of law at the University of Tennessee College of Law and author of many books, including The Credentialed Court: Inside the Cloistered Elite World of American Justice. He's with us from Knoxville. Professor Barton, welcome to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the public defender slice of things, of course, in detail. But just describe to us, what is the archetypal Supreme Court justice right now? What are the ways in which the court's perspective or experience has narrowed?
Yeah, so the book takes a look at every Supreme Court justice from John Jay through Barrett, and it looks at basically what they did before they got on the court. And it turns out that the experiences that justices brought to the court have actually changed a lot over time. And I argue that they've become much narrower and more cloistered and more elite. Oh. So the easiest way to see it is just the change in educational background. The current Supreme Court, if Jackson joined, would have 6 of 8 justices who went to an Ivy League school. And then they would have 8 of 9 justices who went to Harvard or Yale for law school. It would have 5 justices that had formerly clerked on the Supreme Court, including 3 justices who replaced the justice they clerked for, which is like a really weird, very close-knit group of people. And then it would have a bunch of people who had lived and worked in D.C., and who had worked at big law firms in D.C. basically as well.
Okay, so we have an extremely unrepresentative group, just in terms of, let's just call it, law degrees. First of all of them but one coming from 2 law schools. Of course, I can hear the pushback that maybe in the legal field, folks think that those are the best law schools. So why not? Why not pluck your Supreme Court justices from Harvard and Yale? But we can debate that later. But you also said geographic diversity, let alone racial and gender diversity, of course. And interestingly, having replaced the justice they clerked for, plus there's another one, actually, Professor Barton, that if Judge Jackson makes it to the Supreme Court, if I have my numbers here correctly, there will only be 2 justices, her and I believe it's Samuel Alito, who went to public high schools.
Yes, that is right. And I think the rest of them went to Catholic high schools, which is an interesting fact on it for sure. And the bulk of them will have lived in either an urban area or in the suburbs of an urban area. And the bulk of them will be from the Northeast, basically the Acela corridor is where they grew up. But then in their professional lives, they will have spent the great bulk of their time in Washington, D.C.
Wow. Okay. So why does this matter? And I know that sounds like kind of like the most obvious rhetorical question, but I ask it in earnest because every person who gets nominated to the Supreme Court will always say, well, I will apply the law fairly and evenly to all cases. Background shouldn't matter.
Yeah, so let me start with the obvious thing, which is that if confirmed, Jackson will create the most diverse court ever in terms of gender and race, and that's a tremendous achievement. There's a really fun YouTube video that you can search that has every picture of the Supreme Court from the first to the most recent one, and it's laugh-out-loud funny when you first get to Thurgood Marshall. Because you are all of a sudden are aware, like, oh, I've only looked at white males. I've looked at white males for 160 years, and all of a sudden we have a change. And the pictures get more and more diverse as they go. So I just want to make clear that that's salutary and great. That being said, there's more to diversity than just race and gender. And I think it's super worrisome to have that narrow. And it's worrisome partially because it's not representative of the country. But it's also worrisome because decision-making bodies that don't have diversity of experience tend to fall into groupthink. They make worse decisions. They make quicker decisions. They shorthand things. And note, the Supreme Court already only has lawyers on it. So you're already dealing with a pretty narrow group of folks. That's why it's particularly critical to have those lawyers have done different things, lived different places, seen different folks before they get on the court.
Just a little tangent here, though, Professor Barton, and then Judge Gertner, I'll come back to you here. But when you said the Supreme Court only has lawyers on it, it just suddenly occurred to me that, I don't know, for as long as I've been alive, I've just presumed that who else would be on the court?
Oh, yeah, it's not in the Constitution. And actually, Reagan at one point thought about putting Thomas Sowell, who's an economist, onto the court. And the lawyers in the White House were like, oh, please, sir, let's not do that. Okay. But no, they could theoretically appoint a non-lawyer. I just don't think, I mean, we're not even seeing a person who didn't graduate from Harvard or Yale Law School. I think it's going to be a minute before we see a non-lawyer.
My hopes dashed. Okay, Judge Gertner, though. No, but seriously, about, you were shaking your head for a lot of things. First, in terms of the narrowness of the sort of life experience that the current slate of justices have. And then secondly, when Professor Barton was talking about the dangers of groupthink, et cetera. So just your thoughts here.
Well, let me start with groupthink. That's a wonderful point. That's a wonderful point. If you don't, I mean, it seems to the people listening to this that there's a collision between this notion that what I do as a judge will be determined by the law. And in that respect, therefore, everybody should, all judges should look the same, can look the same, because we're all governed by the law. And that is true to a degree, which is that everyone has to move to neutral. Everyone has to apply the same set of laws. But the experience that you have before you went on the bench, the experiences that you lived, your lived experience, will determine how you see the context and can affect how you come out. There's no question about that. So let me give you an example. Ruth Bader Ginsburg famously dissented in the case involving Lilly Ledbetter, who was the person whose salary was discriminatory all from the beginning of the time she was in her job. And the rest of the court said, well, you know, the discrimination started, 10 years before, and sorry, you didn't know about it. You should have sued then. Ginsburg wrote this elaborate dissent saying, nobody knows anybody's salaries. There's no way she could have known. There's no way we could have ever envisioned that. And that was bringing to bear her experience on the application of the law. Same law, but the context was different. Also, the shoe was on the other foot during the Mueller investigations with Republicans. This is a different point. If you recall, people were aghast at prosecutorial power, at Mueller's power in getting people to plead guilty and threatening prosecutions. The Republicans should care that there is someone with defender experience on the bench if they care about excessive government power on the criminal side. They should care as well. And somebody with some sensitivity to that, that would bear on what she or he does.
We're talking about a public defender, though. A woman who's had experience defending people who, by definition, could not afford their own counsel.
Right. But she would understand excessive zeal by police and excessive zeal by prosecutors. Again, everyone has to apply the law, but you don't apply the law in a robotic way. You apply the law bringing to bear your experiences. Oh,
okay. So don't... Not applying the law in a robotic way. Let me ask both of you then here. Is it possible that we are overweighting the importance of her experience as a public defender? Because there are times in which justices, once they make it to the Supreme Court, they don't behave in that robotic way, as you're saying, Judge Gertner. They may issue decisions that are rather surprising, especially to the presidents who nominated them. I mean, I think Professor Barton, Earl Warren seems to pop to mind that he proved frustrating to the president who nominated him. So, I mean, how much can we actually posit or predict from a justice's background about how he or she might behave on the court?
Yeah, so the first thing I'll say is that it sounds really impressive to say she would be the first public defender ever to be on the Supreme Court, but she's not going to be the first person with criminal defense experience. And in fact, all the way through Thurgood Marshall, there was almost always justices on the Supreme Court who had criminal defense experience. I love Thurgood Marshall as an example because he's obviously America's foremost civil rights attorney, along with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But he was a transitional, fantastic criminal defense lawyer who traveled all over the country doing criminal cases and brought that experience with him. But if you go back to John Marshall, often thought of as the greatest Supreme Court justice. And a lot of the early first justices, all of those guys were solo practitioners. And I say guys because it was all men, were solo practitioners. And so they took what came in the door. Famously, Alexander Hamilton and Burr tried criminal cases, but a lot of these early Supreme Court justices had done it as well. That's a common experience on the Supreme Court and one that the Supreme Court used to have represented all the time.
And so how did it change then? What were the
you had that leave the court, and so you just had a much more prevalent prosecutorial bent on the court, which I think I totally agree with Judge Gertner. That's a shame. Like, you want balance on this. And I think, to be fair to Judge Jackson, like, she was a defense lawyer, but then she was on the Sentencing Commission, which is a whole different part of that system where you see a whole different version of it. Mm-hmm. And then she was a district court judge where she was sentencing people. So I think her experience in this regard actually is super well-rounded. She's seen every side of it.
Yeah. Judge Gertner, go ahead.
No, I think that's right. I had forgotten, Professor Barton raised a good point, that there were general practitioners on the court before now. I think that part of it is the politicization of the confirmation process, which is it is simply easier to confirm someone with a big firm background who, you know, has sort of not sullied their hands in criminal defense work or civil rights work, and a prosecutor who, you know, we understand, we believe somehow, the Senate believes, that a prosecutor can move to neutral more quickly than a public defender can. And of course, that's not true. The prosecutor has to move exactly in the way that a defender has to move, but that the prosecutors were easier to confirm. And I think that that's the reason why we have a court that is so homogeneous at this point.
Judge Gertner, that reminded me, years ago, just soon after you retired from the federal bench, one of my colleagues actually interviewed you when your first book came out. And after that interview, I asked you, I said, this was, you know, obviously it wasn't on the air, but I asked you, I said, do you think today, given how contentious confirmation hearings are for the federal bench, let alone the Supreme Court, that you would have been confirmed? And you said no.
Right.
And is it because of your background as a civil rights and criminal defense attorney?
Oh, and more than just being a civil rights and criminal defense lawyer. I mean, I represented women in sexual harassment cases and battered women cases. And no, I mean, I think my confirmation was because Ted Kennedy decided that he really wanted someone like me on the bench. I think President Biden has certainly put up for nomination more public defenders, people involved in the Innocence Project in the past year. That had not been the case before then. That had not been the case before then.
Yeah. It was remarkable to me that, I mean, you've served and served well on the federal bench, but you said with such clarity that given how confirmation hearings go now, there was much about you that you know, shifted by 10 years.
Right. Well, it's a risk avoidance. That's the issue, which makes Judge Jackson's nomination all the more important. Mm. The feeling is that the politicians believe that they risk with having a public defender, or they risk with having a criminal defense lawyer. Let's go for the riskless nomination, which results in a court that looks alike.
Yeah. So I want to shift our focus back to this question of a potential justice's former experience as a public defender. Now, I was looking at article from several years ago in the Michigan Law Review that analyzed how often Supreme Court justices had votes for the government, okay, in constitutional cases and in non-constitutional cases. And this has to do with the fact that right now, as we mentioned, Judge Gertner and Professor Barton, everyone on the court is either a former prosecutor or former corporate lawyer. And the numbers are absolutely fascinating. This Michigan Law Review analysis, again, it's from several years ago, but it found that people like, for example, now the late Chief Justice Rehnquist, in constitutional cases, he voted with the government more than 95% of the time. I'm seeing here Clarence Thomas, Justice Thomas, 85% of the time. Justice, the late Justice Scalia, almost 90% of the time. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, you mentioned her, Judge Gertner, 85% of the time. So there seems to be a pattern. And Professor Barton, I'll turn to you just strictly in terms of, is it fair to say that former prosecutors see an argument made by the government before the court, they see it more favorably? Or is it just that the government's consistently making better arguments?
Well, and I actually think that those results are at least as easily explained by political leanings than they are by experience. And one way you can check is that Sotomayor is a former prosecutor, and I would imagine that her numbers are much lower. So actually, one of the things that people have asked me about the book is they're like, well, I mean, is experience going to change the actual votes in cases? And I think that's actually really a hard one to demonstrate. I think it's a lot easier to demonstrate that experience will change, affects the actual approach that you take to the job. So, for example, all of these people are these amazing, amazing former lawyers. And I don't mean to say just because they have the same background, it's an easy job to get. It's not easy to get into an Ivy League undergrad institution. It's not easy to get into an Ivy League law school. It's really hard to clerk on the Supreme Court. That's the single hardest job for a law grad to get. These people have jumped through some amazingly narrow hoops and have demonstrated what I call technical legal excellence. But the fact that they all have this same background, I think, really affects the types of opinions that we see and the way they make decisions.
Well, Professor Barton, hang on here for just a second, because we do have to quickly take a break. We'll talk a lot more about this when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Judge Nancy Gertner joins us today. She's a retired federal judge who sat on the bench in the Massachusetts District Court. She's a senior lecturer on law at Harvard Law School. Benjamin Barton is with us as well. He's a professor of law at the University of Tennessee College of Law and author of The Credentialed Court, Inside the Cloistered Elite World of American Justice. And we're talking today about the fact that if confirmed, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson would be the first public or former public defender ever to sit on the United States Supreme Court. And today, in fact, her Supreme Court confirmation hearings begin. Now, I want to just shift the focus a little bit to one layer below the Supreme Court and talk about public defenders that have served or are serving on the lower courts in the United States and what we can glean from their experience and the data from their rulings on lower courts. So we reached out to Maya Sen. She's a political scientist at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. She recently co-authored a paper titled How Judges' Professional Experience Impacts Case Outcomes, An Examination of Public Defenders in Criminal Sentencing. Now, in the study, Professor Sen examined about a million federal charges from 2010 to 2019 that resulted in a sentence.
We wanted to see whether the likelihood of incarceration would change if a charge or case was assigned to a former public defender. And what we found is that the answer to that is yes. So if a charge is assigned to someone, so a judge who is a former public defender, the probability that the charge would result in the sentence involving incarceration decreased by about 2 to 3 percentage points.
So 2 to 3% may not seem like a lot, but Professor Sen says that small percentage truly scales up when you consider how many sentences the federal court processes.
We actually walk through this exercise in the paper where we actually calculate if there were more public defenders appointed that they came up to be about 30% of judges, which is about the percentage of judges who are former prosecutors, then you would actually have something on the order, I think, 15,000 fewer criminal incarcerations over a 10-year period.
The biggest difference that a judge with a public defender experience could make, Professor Sen says, comes in cases that do indeed end up with those guilty verdicts.
When we actually look at these verdict trials, where there's a verdict at the end, we find that being assigned to a public defender leads to an incarceration length that's about 18 months shorter on average.
So what difference does Professor Sen think that experience could make then on the Supreme Court?
If I had a guess, someone like Judge Jackson, I think, would be receptive to kinds of criminal procedure claims made by defendants that speak to this right of defendants to have access to high quality counsel. Now, I also think based on what we found in our analysis, she might be also skeptical of sentences that set out to be primarily punitive, like these extremely long, extremely harsh sentences. We see public defenders, in our data at least, being skeptical of those.
That's Maya Sen, political scientist and professor of public policy at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Judge Gertner, I mean, let's get straight to it. We know that there are going to be senators who, starting today, are going to vigorously question Judge Jackson exactly because of, in a sense, what Professor Sen just said, that there seems to be evidence on the lower courts that when you have more public former public defenders there, it leads to, as Professor Sen said, an incarceration length that's 18 months shorter on average. And some senators are going to have a problem with that.
It's late in the day to have a problem with that. For over the past, I guess, 10 years, Republicans and Democrats have decried mass incarceration, have said that we sentence people to too long and we sentence too many people. There was a coalition of Republicans and Democrats that were, including, by the way, the Koch Industries, who were supporting the Republican senators, called Right on Crime, and about how disproportionate our sentences are. So if in fact Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson tempers this incredible punitive and retributive instinct that we've had for the past 40 years, they should not disagree. Fact of the matter is we all agreed on that. We also agreed that there were profound racial disparities. Congress, you know, enacted even under Trump the First Step Act, which was intended to mitigate the harsh effects of punishment. So this distinction should not matter to them. Indeed, they should encourage it.
Well, here's what Senator Mitch McConnell said last Thursday, questioning Judge Jackson's ability to be impartial.
Liberals are saying that Judge Jackson's service as a criminal defense lawyer and then on the U.S. Sentencing Commission give her special empathy for convicted criminals. Her supporters look at her resume and deduce a special empathy for criminals. I guess that means that government prosecutors and innocent crime victims start each trial at a disadvantage. That isn't my assertion. That is what the nominee's liberal supporters are all saying.
Professor Barton, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, so I'll note, first of all, I really agree with what Judge Gertner said. Second, I'll note, the way these attacks come generally, and this is on both sides of the aisle, the most effective way to attack a Supreme Court justice who you think is going to get through, and I think everybody thinks that Jackson is going to get through, is you want to choose something that matches another political talking point. And so the Republicans have wisely selected this. They're trying to really push the Democrats are soft on crime message, and this fits snugly with that message. So I almost think it's chosen for political expedience more than for the actual reality of the situation. And I'll just note, I mean, I think that the criticism of Barrett was very similar. With Barrett, they went after her and said that basically she was going to overturn, and she may or may not, but she was going to overturn all abortion rights, and that's what Republicans wanted to do generally. And again, that was like fit a nice, snugly with a nice political talking point. So I think that that's much more what's going on here than any sort of real searching look at Judge Jackson's record.
Okay, you beat me to that same point, Professor Barton, because I was going to basically say identically that Democrats absolutely questioned now Justice Barrett not only on her background, but her religious beliefs about the abortion question, to a point that it actually made quite a few people uncomfortable. I mean, for example, here's this moment where Senator Dianne Feinstein in 2017, in a Senate hearing, raising her concerns about then-Professor Amy Coney Barrett's ability to separate her faith from her ability to rule impartially. Again, the same idea as a federal appeals judge.
When you read your speeches, the conclusion one draws is that the dogma lives loudly within you. And that's of concern when you come to big issues that large numbers of people have fought for years in this country.
Judge Gertner, you're about to strangle the microphone.
Well, the Linda Greenhouse has just written a book which said that, you know, Dianne Feinstein's questioning was ridiculous. It wasn't a question of Amy Coney Barrett's beliefs. It was a question of what she said would inform her judging. We're not talking private beliefs. She wrote about how her Catholicism would impact on her decisions on the death penalty, how it affected her decisions on abortion. She put in play those beliefs and how they affect her judging. There is nothing comparable with Ketanji Brown Jackson at all. She, her sentencing, her record on the district court shows she sentenced people. There was no, and she, you know, she was careful about those sentences, but there's not a one-to-one correlation. Amy Coney Barrett said there would be a one-to-one correlation between her beliefs and her judging. That's what she wrote about. So Linda Greenhouse was saying that it wasn't a question of private beliefs. You can have private beliefs all you want. But when you say I, as a judge, will enact those beliefs, you're saying something very different.
I see what you're saying. But because I was going to make the point, though, that at the very top of the show, we played that clip from Judge Jackson from her D.C. Court confirmation hearings last year, where she said, indeed, her experience as a public defender have informed how she approaches her role on the bench. So you don't think that that's significantly different, or you do think that that's significantly different from what Justice Barrett was saying?
No, I think it's a fair discussion. I'm not saying anything about the discussion. I'm saying that Judge Feinstein was you know, criticized because she was talking about private beliefs. No, my view is that what the package of who you are as a human being, what you've experienced, impacts your judging. And I think that, therefore, it was a fair question of Justice Barrett. And I think it's a fair question of Justice Jackson, Judge Jackson. I think it's a fair question.
Yeah. So Professor Barton, then, this is exactly the point, right? I mean, you were making it in your book. Judge Gertner has said it. I'm going to sort of paraphrase something that another Harvard Law School professor, Randall Kennedy, recently told me. In his words, he believes that the law is a distillation of our politics. And if we're all here saying that the totality of what someone brings to the bench by virtue of where they grew up, where they went to school, where they went to law school, their legal profession, their beliefs, their gender, their race, then let me ask you, what should we be striving for, Professor Barton, on the court? I mean, is there a kind of, I don't know, I don't want to call it legal, but let's call it civic obligation for the court to be as diverse as the nation or not?
Yeah, so what I would strive to do is to try and return the court to its historical basis, what it used to look like. And you used to just have a much bigger mix of people. So it's not unusual to have a graduate of Harvard on the court. There's been a graduate of either Harvard undergrad or law school on the court from the first court to the last court. That's always been represented on the court. The thing that's unusual is to have only Harvard, Yale, and Ivy League graduates on the court. That's a significant change. We used to have politicians on the court. Roughly a third of the former Supreme Court justices were former politicians who had run for elected office. The last politician we had on the court was Sandra Day O'Connor. She was the last person who faced any voters before she got on the court. We used to have people who really made their bones as lawyers, who were the very, very best lawyers in the country, or at least in their state. And we've completely seen that go away as well. We always have had a meritocracy on the court. Every president has wanted to appoint the best possible person to the court. But we used to have this really broad version of merit that we've really narrowed down to a single path onto the court. And note, it's so narrow. Like, if you have to get into an undergrad institution that's an Ivy League place, then ninth grade algebra really matters. Like, we're just starting this race so much earlier than we used to, and I think that's quite damaging as well.
Judge Gertner, what do you think?
I think that's right. I mean, people talk about diversity, and diversity is more than just the optics of it. As I said, judging is applying the law, you know, fairly, but you do it in the context of what you understand to be important, what you understand to value. You do it in a context, and you want. I think I take Professor Barton's point a few minutes ago. There's no reason to talk to each other if you're all alike. And that makes a difference, because judging is about tempering your instincts with what your understanding of the law is. When I was only a district court judge, but I cared about whether I would be reversed. I cared about how my colleagues saw me, and it tempered my approaches to the law, and that's as it should be. If you're all alike, and this court in particular is all alike, there is no discussion. There is no back and forth. There's no tempering your experiences in this way. And so I get back to the point I made at the beginning. Justice O'Connor would talk about how Thurgood Marshall would change the discussion in the room. And when they talked about cases, he would raise an issue based on his experience that none of the others had seen. I would hope that Ketanji Brown Jackson would do the same.
Okay, one more thing here, because, again, the confirmation hearings are will be well underway. I just want to focus on the kinds of questions that we can see will be asked of her, because they were already asked last year when, again, she was nominated to the D.C. Circuit Court. So here's Senator Tom Cotton during those April 2021 hearings.
In your career before you were a judge, have you ever represented a terrorist at Guantanamo Bay?
About 16 years ago, when I was a federal public defender.
Okay, so this Guantanamo Bay issue, it fascinates me to no end. And Benjamin Barton, let me first turn to you. We've just got a couple minutes left here. You know, we have had cases that emerged from Guantanamo that ended up at the United States Supreme Court, really fundamental ones, like habeas corpus cases. About do people have a right to, you know, even see their lawyer if they're held at a base in Cuba? Do you think that just your quick take on the Guantanamo Bay question and the fact that Judge Jackson did indeed serve as a public defender for defendants there?
So I feel the same way about Guantanamo Bay as I do just about a run-of-the-mill drug case. I mean, I think being a public defender is just being a criminal defense lawyer, and that has been a really, really common experience. Lots and lots and lots of lawyers have done that and gone on to be successful judges and justices. So I recognize this is a great political talking point for Senator Cotton and for others, but I just don't see it as an actual effect on the court.
I completely agree. One of the things about public defenders is that they have to take the cases that come in the door. So in order to criticize her for the cases she took is absurd. A public defender takes what's in the door. And in addition, this was a case that, as you said, these were cases that raised fundamental questions about the American constitutional system. So these were terribly important cases to raise. I mean, this is really just a parody. Senator Cotton's comments are just a parody of Republican talking points, and that's it. There's really no meaningful. There's nothing backing that at all. There's nothing behind it.
Well, Judge Nancy Gertner, retired judge who served on the district court in Massachusetts. She's a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and has a forthcoming book out next month.
Right.
About the rulings of Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Right.
Okay, so we're looking forward to that, Judge Gertner. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Benjamin Barton, professor of law at the University of Tennessee College of Law and author of The Credentialed Court, Inside the Cloistered Elite World of American Justice. Professor Barton, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.